to the appeal of Gregory Acala.
May it please the court, counsel. Gregory Acala, pro se, and on behalf of third party defendant, Richards Brick Company, for the appellants. This is our appeal for what I assume was a Rule 11 C order against me. With all respect to the court, I say I assume because until the order on my Rule 59E motion on December 15th of 2004, the record was devoid of any statutory or procedural authority for sanctions. Put simply, jurisdictionally, the order did not sustain relief under Rule 11. On November 23rd of 2004, the district court awarded sanctions under rather unusual circumstances. The circumstances became more confusing when Rule 11 was cited for the first time in the record on December 15th, 2004. I would respectfully say that the award under 11C1 has no basis in the record for six distinct reasons. There is no Rule 11C1A motion served upon me. There is no Rule 11C1A motion drafted in a separate pleading to put me on notice of an 11 violation. There was no Rule 11C1A motion filed. There was no Rule 11C1B sui sponte award describing any sanctionable conduct on my behalf.
So why don't we conclude from all this that this wasn't a Rule 11 sanction at all? And that it was a sanction pursuant to other authorities, specifically 28 U.S. Code Section 1927, or the court's inherent authority to sanction vexatious conduct by attorneys.
You know, I would not conclude that, but for the Rule 59E, which I took in December, I believe that conclusion could have properly been taken. I believe that Judge Murphy clarified that on the record in the Rule 59E ruling on December 15th, when he specifically said, this is not a case where the court on its own motion had issued sanctions. Rather, it is a case where counsel has requested sanctions. So I would say if I had reviewed or appealed directly from the November 23rd, I don't know if we ever would have known the answer to that question.
There was a motion for sanctions brought, for costs and fees brought by your opponents in this case.
The motion for
it wasn't a Rule 11 motion, nor would there have been a basis for a Rule 11 motion because you hadn't submitted a signed pleading that was not based on a good faith factual and legal argument. So it's simply not a Rule 11 case, except for your attempts to procedurally make it that so that you can get the order reversed.
I would respectfully disagree with that, and I would say that the order of December 15th under 59E, just like in Johnson versus Waddle, makes it a Rule 11 order because it says it was on the motion of counsel.
It doesn't make it a Rule 11 order. The judge didn't specifically say, I hereby convert my sanctions order into a Rule 11 order.
But conversely, the court specifically said it was not on the court's motion or inherent authority.
Right. The court said it was on motion of counsel and not under Rule 11, but because of conduct-based violations, not submission of pleadings that aren't signed in good faith.
I would respectfully submit, if it were under another section of the code, it wasn't awarded in that manner, and how was I to respond to it? We basically have me walking into court, and with all respect to the court, I do indemnity contracts and insurance coverage all the time.
I'd like to interrupt, counsel. You didn't walk into court. You failed to show up.
Your Honor, I had an associate from my downstate office handle it, economically handle it, as I do all business from the office.
She was taking a different position from you. She was taking a completely adverse position from yours and had negotiated the settlement, the underlying settlement that's at issue here, which apparently you're not challenging anymore.
Your Honor, with all respect, I do challenge and ask for relief on the underlying award.
You specifically withdrew that in your reply brief, counsel.
In my brief, Your Honor, I do state that I believe the underlying award has to be vacated. I did obtain permission, which I'll represent to the court as I did in my reply brief, to forego that and just direct my attention to the sanctions. However, I believe that it's inherent that what happened that day needs to be addressed. For one reason, obviously, I don't address in my brief. We all know that as a matter of any law, in Illinois particularly, court does not have jurisdiction to enter an order of settlement unless the client consents. We have a situation in this case.
Well, you say Ms. Richardson is an associate in your law firm, is that correct?
Ms. Anderson.
Anderson, all right, yeah.
Yes, Your Honor.
And you're both representing
Richardson. Yes, Your Honor.
She negotiated a settlement and agreed to it.
Your Honor, there's a question of what the settlement was. Yes, there was totally a liability settlement negotiated. That's the reason.
It's supposedly, but I mean, that's a fact, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor. As a matter of fact, on that first
meeting, you apparently didn't like the settlement after it was negotiated.
That's not true, Your Honor. Specifically, what happened was I had received the initial draft of the release. It was totally acceptable to me, as it would be in any third-party case. I was waiving my liability. I had Kentucky protection, and the defendant was granting a release. Thereafter, there comes a release, which turns into a mutual release, requesting the release of parties not before the court. I believe that the confusion is apparent from somebody who I believe speaks more eloquently and has no bias or prejudice, and that is the plaintiff's counsel. Plaintiff comes into court, I think we have to go to the background of this case, with a motion supported by two releases. He says, here's two releases, I don't know which one to sign. If there was a settlement negotiated by the plaintiff and all the parties of record, don't you think that the plaintiff would have moved for relief and says, no, that's not the deal. This is, I'm signing this release and I want my check. Instead, the plaintiff specifically takes the time to come into court on a motion and says, I'm faced with these two releases. I believe my surprise to the second release is shown. I realize that my email was quite sarcastic. And to place that in background, I had in this case, as an officer of the court, assumed a duty to remind my opponent that there wasn't tender of insurance. I thought that that was my duty in light of the upcoming release.
Counsel, there's also a motion for sanctions for taking this appeal. You want to address that as well?
Yes, I certainly would, Your Honor. I don't believe that this case warrants Federal Rule of Appellate Procedure 38 sanctions. I would point out, Your Honor, that I never conceded, as they say in the motion, service notice, the application of any sanction rule. As a matter of fact, my first notice of being sanctioned, and once again not in a specific pleading, was the court's order, and I immediately addressed it under Rule 59, which I believe Johnson versus Waddle gives me the right to do. I believe that Johnson is right on point with this case, irrespective of whether you pull the sanctions out of the code or Rule 11.
You received notice of the motion to enforce the settlement and for costs and fees as a sanction, right?
Your Honor, the motion had alluded to costs and fees in it, which I don't believe was proper on its face.
So the answer to my question is yes, you received notice.
Two
attorneys.
Two counsels specifically say on the record, Your Honor, and I can give you the cite, Judge Murphy says, are you requesting sanctions? They say there's no motion on file. Judge Murphy, I would suggest, eggs them on and says, don't you want your time here today and your airplane fee? And they say yes. But, you know, one thing that I found interesting was when I initially looked at the record, I had thought that if I were before the court, I certainly would say there was a separate motion on file when there wasn't. And counsel specifically said that. And notwithstanding that, Judge Murphy awarded the sanctions. I point out, and I know it's immaterial, this is the first time in my practice of law in the federal court or in a state court that I've been sanctioned. I take it very seriously. As a matter of fact, I would have been more prone to allow this sanction to go
And luckily, a colleague from downstate had reminded me that I practice on a multi-state basis, and this is going to be on every petition that I request Pohawk Beach readmission in the United States. I take that quite seriously. In summary, I just point out that I don't believe that there was any underlying basis for the sanctions against me in this appeal, and accordingly, I don't think that that would create an independent basis under Rule 38 to come in and contest that. I would respectfully request the court to reverse the November 23rd order of sanctions. I would also respectfully request the court to reverse the denial of the Rule 59 and grant relief on that, reversing the November 23rd order. Thank you.
Morning, Your Honors. James Brand for the appellees. There are two issues here and a third one based on the Rule 38 motion. The first issue is whether the district court properly enforced the settlement. I think that it obviously did. As your questions have pointed out, there is no dispute here in terms of the facts that were in front of the district court that all of the attorneys that were actually involved in the negotiations all testified that all the parties agreed to release and dismiss all claims related to the case. All. There's no ambiguity about that. The attorneys that were involved all testified to that. Mr. Vakala cannot dispute that. He wasn't involved. He didn't show up at the hearing. His associate did, and his associate did not dispute that. In fact, Richards and Mr. Vakala and his associate all agreed that the initial draft release embodied the terms of the agreement. But that release specifically and clearly says, and I'm paraphrasing, that all the parties desire to compromise, settle, and conclude all the various disputes, controversies, claims, and causes of actions.
What's this business about the plaintiff saying, you know, which release to sign?
Mr. Carlson, the attorney for the plaintiff, Del Pazzo, said, I've got two releases, one the initial draft release, the second one the mutual release. So he basically said, I don't care which one I'm supposed to sign, but I want some direction. And the reason he did is because the initial draft release had an indemnity provision in there. And that indemnity provision is important because it supports our position. The indemnity provision basically said that Mr. Del Pazzo would indemnify my client and the other appellee, Basic, if he brought a claim for insurance coverage. And he obviously didn't want to sign anything like that, and he never had any intent that that was part of the settlement agreement. So that was why he wanted some instruction from the court, and we pointed out to him correctly, just sign the mutual release, and he did, because we'll figure out whether Richards should sign the mutual release later. He had no dog in that fight, as Mr. Vakala himself points out.
Do we even need to address the issue of the underlying settlement agreement since Mr. Vakala conceded in his reply brief that this case is only about, this appeal is only about the so-called Rule 11 issue?
It's hard to interpret some of his writings, but I think that's a reasonable interpretation, and if that is the correct one, then yes, you are right, Your Honor. You don't really need to address that. I'll move on to the sanctions. The district court properly exercised its discretion in entering sanctions against Mr. Vakala. In fact, we begged him before this ever came down, please reconsider your position. You're going to force us to go down there, expend our clients' money for a totally unnecessary reason. Your own associate said that you have settled all the claims. We all knew that that was what this was all about, that we were intending to buy our peace, not buy later litigation. And in fact, your position that there might be insurance coverage is, to put it bluntly, delusional. His first statement, his first position is that there might be coverage because the contracts might have required us to name his client as an additional insured. The problem is, he had the contracts. He knew they did not contain any such provision. So that was a frivolous idea. His second idea was that there might be coverage under a vendor's endorsement. If he had bothered to look at any case dealing with vendor's endorsement, he would have known that to be covered as a putative insured under a vendor's endorsement, you have to be a vendor, a seller of a product, or a distributor. You cannot be a purchaser and be covered under that. So that obviously is a frivolous claim. So there are two aspects of his conduct that was sanctionable. One is he was trying to sidestep an agreement that his associate had entered into. With his authority, he expressly stated on the record that his associate had full authority to settle the case. And second, not only did he try and sidestep that, but it's the reason that he was sidestepping it was itself frivolous and sanctionable. The only objections that he raises on appeal to the entry of sanctions are the procedural, technical bases under Rule 11, which, as Judge Sykes has pointed out, have no possible application here. He refused to sign something. He didn't sign a pleading under Rule 11. Rule 11 never applied. The judge did not say that he imposed sanctions under Rule 11. In fact, he said, this is not a situation where I impose sanctions sua sponte under Rule 11.
And the requests for sanctions were specifically included in the pleadings seeking enforcement of the settlement agreement, as I recall the record, or at least two out of three pleadings.
There were two out of the three motions that in their title and in the prayer for relief and in the opening paragraph all asked for costs and fees, precisely because we all said that we should not have to be coming down here on this motion. This was totally unnecessary. So we did describe the conduct that was sanctionable in the motions themselves. He had full notice and opportunity to come down there and defend himself. He chose not to, and his associate undercut his position that this was defensible. And in terms of the Rule 38 motion, it's more of the same. His only defense to that, he doesn't respond at all to the idea that the idea of enforcing the settlement was sanctionable. And his only response, again, is under Rule 11, which is totally irrelevant here. And the fact that he has now conceded the motion to enforce the settlement is important because, quite frankly, if all we were doing was defending $2,000 in sanctions, we might not have expended as much effort as we did defending this appeal. That settlement in and of itself was very important to us, very valuable to us, and that prompted additional efforts on appeal, which we never should have had to expend. Thank you.
Thank you. The case will be taken under advisement, and the court will be in recess until 9:30 tomorrow.